From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Happy Thanksgiving. For this holiday show, we have two interviews we especially like from our archives. We'll hear from Eileen Farrell, a singer who is loved for her interpretations of opera and American popular song. Also today, an interview with actor John Leguizamo. He co-stars with Al Pacino in the movie Carlito's Way. He plays a tough guy, but Leguizamo first became known for comedy with his one-man show Mambo Mouth, a satirical look at Latino life. And a new generation of Cartwrights is returning to the Ponderosa. TV critic David Bianculli reviews the new telemovie, Bonanza. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Negotiators for the United Mine Workers Union and major coal companies are still working on the wording of a contract to end a six-month-old coal strike. But officials from the union and social services agencies are expressing relief that the strike is expected to be over soon. Jim Wallace of West Virginia Public Radio reports.
Salvation Army officials in West Virginia say they've been straining the past few months to meet the human needs of striking miners at a time when donations have been down because of the strike. UMW International Vice President Cecil Roberts says the strike has been tough on many miners.
We've got guys in the coal fields who've come very near losing their homes. They're behind in house payments. It's been a difficult financial time putting kids in school. The union's done everything that they can to help with that. But there's been a lot of pain and a lot of time, a lot of effort go into this, and a lot of suffering.
Roberts joined West Virginia Governor Gaston Caperton at the state capitol to distribute 200 Thanksgiving turkeys to needy miners. For National Public Radio, I'm Jim Wallace in Charleston, West Virginia.
After a four-week suspension, aid convoys fanned out again throughout central Bosnia today. They delivered much-needed food and winter supplies to millions of people. NPR's Sylvia Poggioli reports from Zagreb.
For the second day in a row, UN aid trucks moved through Bosnia today, but UN officials accused Bosnian Serbs of delaying convoys. A spokesman said the Serbs were deliberately hampering the delivery of flour, shoes, plastic sheeting, and nails to the eastern Muslim enclave of Zepa. The delay forced the cancellation of another convoy tomorrow for the northern town of Tuzla, which for the last several weeks has had sufficient food for only 12% of its inhabitants. Although nearly 1,000 tons of supplies were delivered yesterday, UN officials say not enough is getting through and that the number of people in need is growing every day. In the central town of Zenica, people lined the streets to welcome the first convoy in a month. And in Sarajevo, for the first time in 19 months of siege, the International Red Cross launched soup kitchens and meal deliveries to 15,000 people. This is Sylvia Poggioli in Zagreb.
African National Congress leader Nelson Mandela warned today that thousands of innocent white people could lose their lives if right-wing extremists carry out their threat of a civil war. Mandela gave the warning at a speech today in a conservative Afrikaner town near Johannesburg. Three groups have threatened a civil war if their demands for a separate white homeland are not met. They're the neo-Nazi Afrikaner Resistance Movement, the Opposition Conservative Party, and the Afrikaner People's Front. Mandela charged that the right-wingers are already stocking weapons in preparation for violence. This is NPR. British author and composer Anthony Burgess died today in London after a long battle with cancer. He was 76. Burgess was the author of more than 50 novels, but he was probably best known for the futuristic fantasy A Clockwork Orange. He began writing seriously to raise money after he was diagnosed with a brain tumor so that the royalties would support his wife after his death. That was 37 years ago. He was so prolific that neither his agent nor his publisher could provide the exact number of books he wrote. Food banks and soup kitchens across the country are facing shortages this Thanksgiving. Many charities depend on holiday season goodwill to keep up with the demand for hot meals and canned food. But this year, donations by both individuals and corporations are down, and in many areas, the need for food aid is going up. Dave Krepko is director of the Daily Bread Food Bank in Miami. He says his group is being flooded with requests for help.
Our economy still hasn't come back into full swing. We're still facing levels of unemployment. And here in particular, and in South Dade, we're still suffering from the legacy of Hurricane Andrew. There's still many, many needy people. We're in for a very long rebuilding effort in that community.
Dave Krepko in Miami. A new study shows that it costs more to treat a child for a gunshot wound than it would cost to send that child to a private college for a year. If that conclusion doesn't seem especially relevant, the National Association of Children's Hospitals reports that more than 5,000 people under the age of 19 were killed by gunfire in 1991. The average cost of treating a wounded child in the hospital was more than $14,000, just about what a four-year private college would charge for tuition, room, and board. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Eileen Farrell is generally acknowledged to be the first opera singer to have a hit pop album. That was her 1960 recording of Got a Right to Sing the Blues. But more important, at the age of 73, she's still considered by many to be the best example of an opera singer who truly understands what to do with American popular song. Farrell is not only unpretentious as a pop singer, she was known for her unpretentiousness in the world of opera. She sang with the Met for 5 seasons and had a long, successful concert career. In 1959, the music critic Winthrop Sargent described her as unquestionably one of the greatest dramatic sopranos alive. I spoke with her last year after the release of her album, It's Over. From that album, here's I'm Through With Love.
I'm through with love. I'll never fall again. Said adieu to love. Don't ever call again, for I must have you or no one. And so I'm through with love. I've locked my heart, I'll keep my feelings there. I have stocked my heart with icy frigid air. And I mean to care for no one, because I'm through with love.
What are some of the mistakes you think that some opera singers make when they try to sing pop?
Well, I think that, most singers, the voice is first with them. They're thinking of their voice all the time. And instead of paying attention to the words, they may be paying attention to the words, but they're also thinking of the voice. The voice is it. Well, I have never, like my teacher always used to say, don't listen to yourself, because if you listen to yourself, you're going to get into trouble. In other words, you'll always hear yourself, but don't listen. Don't concentrate on how you sound, because you're listening to the final effect, what people are going to hear. So therefore, you're concentrating on the wrong thing. You should concentrate on what you have to do as far as your breath is concerned, and as far as placing, and I don't mean to use that word, placing, but singing forward and using your breath. And if you concentrate on those things, the result is going to be there.
Your new album, It's Over, is one of a series of recent recordings that you've made on the label Reference Recordings.
Yes.
What got you back into doing these kinds of pop songs, recording them?
Oh, well, let me see. 6 years ago, my husband died, and I just got into a real funk, and I didn't want to sing at all. I was very depressed. And Lunis McGlowan, who, as a matter of fact, Lunis and I had a show on...
NPR.
Yes, we did years ago, but we did 12 weeks. And so Lunis kept saying to me, come on, you got to start singing. I said, no, I don't got to. I don't have to do anything I don't want to do at this time of my life. And he said, no, come on, you've got to sing. So... I went down to Lunis is in North Carolina. So I went down and We started fooling around with the piano, and he would pick out a song. And I think, oh, God, that's so sad. And I'd start to cry, and I couldn't sing. So finally, I got a letter from Tam Henderson, who owns Reference Recordings, and just a note saying that he had a small company, and he would like, he'd been a fan of mine for years, and he would like to record me. So I thought, well, what have I got to lose? You know, I don't know if it's going to be good or bad. So I said, okay, we'll do one. So he went down to North Carolina, and we, I forget the first one we did. I guess it was probably Harold Arlen, because I love him so much. And we started to make these records, and lo and behold, I now have seven, and we're working on the eighth.
Great.
Yeah.
So you said you when you started to sing these songs again, you'd end up crying in the middle of songs.
Oh, honey, I still do.
Really?
Oh, God, yes. Yeah, because I love sad songs.
Was it always that way, or did that have something to do with your husband's death?
It was always that way. I mean, my husband's death had a great deal to do with it, of course. But, for instance, I could never sing Butterfly. That music in Butterfly just pulverizes me. I just completely go to pieces. And I remember years ago, Eric Leinsdorf said that he wanted me to record Butterfly with him. And I said, I can't. He said, of course you can. I said, no, I cry. He said, that's the most stupid thing I've ever heard in my life. So we went into a studio, and he started, you know, playing the Butterfly. And we got to such a spot, and all I have to hear is the music. I didn't even open my mouth yet. And the tears started, and he says, oh, you've got to stop that. I said, yeah, easy for you.
So what happened?
I didn't do it.
Did you ever start crying during a performance on stage?
No. The nearest thing I have, but I have to keep talking to myself all the time. You know, you can't do this, you can't do that. While I'm singing, I'm talking to myself. It was the Giancarlo Minotti's To This We've Come. That is pretty... That's a pretty tough message. And I have gotten caught up with that a couple of times. But I got to the point where I said, well, you know, you just can't do this anymore. So, I mean, I can do the aria, but not get carried away by it.
Well, since you've mentioned it, why don't we hear that aria?
No, speaking of it.
Speaking
okay.
of it. This is from Giancarlo Minotti's opera, The Consul. And we'll hear you singing the aria To This We've Come with Thomas Schippers conducting the London Symphony Orchestra. Do you remember the making of this recording?
Oh, yes.
Did tears come to your eyes during this?
No, because I tell you, we were in London doing this, and Giancarlo, he came to the recording session. And I was petrified. Here he is sitting there in the studio, and I can see him through the glass, and I'm singing his To This We've Come. And I thought, oh, God, I've got to do this right. And he's listening and listening, and he's so pensive looking. And I thought, oh, my God, I hope it comes out all right. So I was pretty on edge during that recording.
Okay. You're just joining us. My guest is Eileen Farrell. Let's go back to your childhood.
Oh.
Now, your parents had a vaudeville act.
Yes,
the group
they
was called the Singing O'Farrells.
That's right.
What was the act?
Well, my mother was a soprano. She, as a matter of fact, she was a coloratura. And I don't think she did that on the stage. I'm not so sure, but she was a soprano. My father was a high baritone. And my father also imitated bird whistles. He could whistle like anything.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah. And then my father played most all musical instruments, which they did. So, I mean, this was long before I came along. And but they did the East Coast circuit, and they were, I don't know how many years, but I still have some of their reviews, the singing O'Farrells.
So did they perform after you were born?
No, no. My mother was an organist in church. My mother taught piano and she taught voice. And my father, in order to earn a living for us kids, he was a house painter.
Who got serious about your voice first, your mother or
my
you?
Mother. My mother. Oh, me. Oh, that was the last thing in the world. I mean, I don't know. When I was in high school, I don't know whatever I thought I was going to be, but I had no ambitions to be anything, really. Nothing. Just to have a good time. And when I graduated from high school, my mother said, we used to get the New York Times every Sunday, and there was an ad singing teacher, and my mother knew her because my mother studied with the same teacher that she did. And so she said, we're going to go down and see if she thinks that, you know, you have a voice. We'll go to New York, because we were living in Rhode Island at that time. So we went to New York, and I was more excited to go to New York. That's a great, that was wonderful. I'd never been there before. So I sang for this woman, and she said, yes, she'd take me. So I went back home, and it was in August. No, whenever. September, I guess it was. I went back to New York, and I studied with this woman, and I studied with her about 5 years. She didn't do me any harm, but she didn't correct me very much.
What needed correcting?
I don't know. See, because I found out later that I was her first pupil. Very much later. And she would say, well, now that sounds pretty good. You know, and I said, oh, I guess it's okay. But she would give me some, vocalizings to do, and I did that. And then I had never learned German before, and I had to learn German. And I was learning sight reading, taking those lessons. And then I had to, if I was going to stay in New York, which to me I wasn't going to because I had never been away from home this long, and I told my mother I wasn't going to stay, and my mother said, oh, yes, you are. So I had to have a job in order to stay. So I went to CBS to audition to get into the chorus because that's about all I could, you know, do was sing.
This was CBS Radio.
CBS Radio, yes. This is in 1940.
Mm-hmm. So you auditioned to be in the chorus. You ended up with your own radio show, though.
That's right. I was in the chorus for about 3 months, and then they offered me my own radio show. Half-hour radio show once a week, and I was there for 7 years.
So what would you sing on your radio show?
It was a half-hour show. I would do one aria and at least one song in either German, French, or Italian. Then the orchestra would do a couple of numbers, and then I would sing something in English. And so therefore, it depended upon what the timing of the orchestra and my songs. So I did that because it was just a half-hour show. I did that every week for 7 years.
Did you have a theme?
Yes.
What was it?
It was Let My Song Fill Your Heart.
Uh-huh.
Ernest Charles wrote that years ago.
How did that go?
Let my song fill your heart with its melody, oh, so divine. And that's about all they ever heard.
And then an announcer came on.
That's
and said,
right.
Eileen Farrell.
Yeah, right. Here she is. Da, 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 da.
And who was your sponsor?
Oh, it was no sponsor.
No sponsor?
No. Oh, no, 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 no. That was, strictly CBS. In those days, CBS did a tremendous amount of good music because they had the symphony. And they had several shows, I think. One, I forget what one was called. I was on, and several other people had their own shows, and they were not sponsored at all.
Mm-hmm. No, it was around 1940 that you started your radio show.
Right.
It was about 20 years later, in 1960, that you joined the Met.
Yes.
Can you give me a really quick sense of what happened in between?
Oh, from radio, I did concerts all over the place.
Right.
Concerts. Then I sang with orchestras, doing arias with orchestra. And I did some recordings. And I did I did quite a few TV things. I did a lot of Gary Moore shows.
Oh, yeah.
A lot of Ed Sullivan
shows.
Yeah,
yeah.
And then it was, I forget when it was that one day the phone rang, and it was Mr. Bing. And he said to me, I've read several times that the reason you haven't, you are not at the Metropolitan is because you have never been asked. And I said, that's true. I never have been asked. So he says, well, I'm asking you. So that's how that started.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Eileen Farrell. And we're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Eileen Farrell. You stayed with the Met for 5 seasons.
Yes.
What were the reasons behind your leaving?
Well, the last year I was there, he being Mr. Bing, offered me 2 performances of Chenier. And then he asked me if I would do Wozzeck in English. And I said, no, I wouldn't do Wozzeck in English. I had done it in German. And I had recorded it in German, and I said, I'm not about to relearn an opera, because I had already done that many years ago with another Strauss opera, Ariadne. And it's very difficult. And I thought, at this stage of the game, I'm not going to start doing that. So when I said no to him, I had a feeling that that was it. So the next season, my manager called him to say, you know, what do you have to offer next year? Because we have to plan concerts around it. And he said, we have nothing to offer her next year unless one of our foreign artists will relinquish a role to her, then she can have it. And I said to him, no thanks. I said to my manager, you tell him no thanks and take my name off the roster. So that's just the way it ended.
Were you very sorry?
Yes, I was. I loved singing opera. I loved it. But of course, I was doing so many other things. But today, when I'm not doing all these things, I think the thing I miss most is the opera, because I loved being on stage and I loved singing with other people. It's a wonderful experience.
When you came to opera, having been used to radio and to mm-hmm. concert performance, what was newest to you that was the most challenging to get used to?
Memorizing. At least in radio, you know, I've got the music in front of me. I can't forget a word. I can't forget a note. But memorizing was kind of, it wasn't difficult for me, but I had to know it backwards and forwards, you know, and I used to learn it as a play. I used to speak it. I spoke all my lines before I ever sang them. And so that by the time I got to the music, I didn't have to worry about the words.
Right. So did you do that with jazz songs, too? Speak them first?
Naturally. But I know an awful lot of jazz music. I really do.
Yeah.
And if I find something, I always read the words first. Read the words first, because words are the most important thing. Breathing and words are the most important thing in singing. Because mm-hmm. if you can't understand your words, I mean, you're just not getting your message across, and nobody knows what you're talking about. You see, and I approach it as I'm talking. Not that I'm singing, because I approach singing as I'm talking.
Many years ago, the writer Winthrop Sargent profiled you in the New Yorker magazine.
Yeah.
And that became a chapter in his book, Divas.
Uh-huh.
And he wrote about you that, you know, Eileen Farrell had never had the passionate devotion to a career that inspires most divas. She was happier as a housewife. And he also wrote that you distrusted the opera world with all its exotic surroundings. How much of that do you think of as being true?
I think the first part is true. The second part is not true.
That it's true that you didn't have a passionate devotion to your career.
I didn't. I never had a passionate. What is the word? A passionate
devotion.
Devotion to anything. I don't think. I just look. As long as I was singing, that's all I cared. I love to sing. That's my big thing. I just love to sing. And whatever I sing, I mean, I don't sing it unless I love to sing it.
You said that part of what Winthrop Sargent said wasn't true. Is that the part about distrusting the opera world?
Yeah. No, that's not true.
Yeah.
No, because I have so many friends that are in the opera world, yeah. And they're wonderful friends.
Now, you're not performing anymore.
No. I don't want to have the tension. I don't want to have the nerves that I get now that I'm older.
You're more nervous now as a performer than you were when you were younger?
Oh, yes.
Why is that?
I don't know. I just don't know. I mean, in singing in front of people, I am. But like a whole audience. But doing a recording, that's an awful lot of fun. Because you're in a studio and you've got some guys in the orchestra. They're sitting there and they're playing. And if I'm not with the orchestra, I'm with a trio. And it's a lot of fun. It's very relaxed, you know. And I move around and I, you know, it's great. It's very rewarding. See, and I'm happy because I'm singing. And that's all that matters, is that I sing.
Listen, of all the Ed Sullivan shows that you've done,
yeah.
Which one really stands out in your mind?
Oh, God. Well, one night he called me Eileen O'Farrell.
Well, that's your original name, right?
No, that was my original name is Eileen Farrell.
But your parents were the singing O'Farrell.
Yeah, I know. They used the O.
Oh, they just used it. I see.
Yeah.
Right.
Because now I found out that O means the son of. since I've been to Ireland 3 times, it's such a wonderful place. But anyway, to get back to what?
Sullivan.
Oh, yeah. And then, because, you do it in all one day. You get there at 8 o'clock in the morning, and then you rehearse, and then you have to tape it in the afternoon so he could watch it. And then you do it again at night, and that's live, And so that Sunday is just terrible. So I had rehearsed, and then it came, we taped it for the dress rehearsal. And then after the dress rehearsal, after he heard the tape, he said, I don't like that pop, because I always used to sing an aria and a pop tune.
Uh-huh.
He said, I don't like that tune. And I thought, well, tough buddy, it's Sunday. So that meant that they had to get the orchestrations down to the theater. And everybody had gone out to get their dinner before 8 o'clock, see? And I'm just sitting there, and I had to find another song that Ed would approve of. So he approved of one, so we passed out all the music, and then I sang that. And he said, yeah, that'll be okay. So then I, try to get my nerves settled down, and then that night I went out and he introduced me and I sang the aria, and then he introduced that I was going to sing such and such a song, and it was the song that he didn't want me to sing.
Oh, so what'd you do?
At that point I didn't know what I was going to sing. I hadn't the slightest idea what that song was that we had changed to. I tell you, that was a moment of really, I could have died. Oh, I could have killed him. I could have killed him. So the orchestra started the introduction, and the Lord was with me, because I recognized from the introduction, and I started to sing, and I sang the whole thing. Well, I had five or six shows to do with him, and I canceled the rest of them. I think I cannot go through this. Life is too short. But he was a very funny man, though, and he didn't know it.
Yeah.
It's true.
So that was your last Sullivan show?
Yeah, sure was.
Wow.
It sure was. But I did a lot before that.
Yeah. Well, Eileen Farrell, it's been just a great pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you.
I thank you very much.
Well, I thank you for asking me.
Eileen Farrell, her latest album is called Here, and it's on Elba Records. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Lately, I find myself out gazing at stars, hearing guitars.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. John Leguizamo's one-man show, Mambo Mouth, was a satirical look at Latino life in America. It was an off-Broadway hit and was later shown on HBO. Leguizamo followed that with another hit one-man show, Spikorama. Now Leguizamo's film career is taking off. He starred in Super Mario Brothers and is currently co-starring with Al Pacino in Carlito's Way. Coming up, a talk with John Leguizamo. Also, more life lessons from the Cartwright family. TV critic David Bianculli reviews the new Bonanza telemovie, which introduces a new generation of Cartwrights. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Laura Kanoy. Winter storm warnings are in effect across portions of the northern plains and upper Midwest, and a strong winter storm is heading east. From member station WOI in Ames, Iowa, Joyce Russell reports.
10 inches of snow fell over parts of northwest Iowa, slowing holiday travel. Roads and highways remain slippery. Freezing rain and freezing drizzle followed the snow, and temperatures have lingered in the teens with wind chill readings in the single digits. Iowa highway authorities report 2 fatal traffic accidents caused by ice. The Weather Service says the heaviest snow today will be in northern Minnesota. More snow is likely across Minnesota and Iowa tomorrow as the system moves slowly off to the southeast. For National Public Radio, this is Joyce Russell in Ames, Iowa.
Lawyers for Haitian refugees in the United States today gave a Thanksgiving Day plea to immigration officials to free 8 refugees detained in Louisiana for almost a year. Attorney Steve Forrester says the Louisiana 8 are being held as criminals, although they've committed no crime. A major civil rights group is reportedly considering a boycott of telephone giant AT&T. Today's Atlanta Constitution Journal says the Southern Christian Leadership Conference plans to hold community meetings to discuss AT&T's treatment of minority employees. Conference President Joseph Lowry says his group has received an overwhelming number of requests from current and former AT&T workers to examine the company's record on racial issues. The phone company has met with Lowry, outlining its plans to hire more minorities. The United Nations says Bosnian Serbs are blocking efforts to bring food and supplies to millions of people threatened by bitterly cold weather. The charge comes one day after the UN resumed land deliveries. Richard Carruthers reports from Zagreb.
One convoy has reached the northeastern Muslim-held town of Tuzla, loaded with 78 tons of flour. For the past month, only 12% of the inhabitants' food needs have been met. In the central town of Zenica, people lined the streets to welcome their first convoy, which arrived late Wednesday. But the UN says it's still being obstructed. Trucks carrying flour, shoes, plastic sheeting and nails for the Muslim enclave of Zepa in eastern Bosnia were delayed for 3 hours by Serbs. They searched another convoy twice before allowing it to move on. A UN spokesman said clearly and intentionally Serbs are delaying relief aid. They replied that searches were necessary because attempts to smuggle contraband, including ammunition, had been discovered previously. For National Public Radio, this is Richard Carruthers in Zagreb.
Egypt's prime minister narrowly escaped death today after Muslim fundamentalists tried to blow up his car. The bomb went off as Premier Atef Sadki was being driven to his office in Cairo. One girl was killed in the blast and 18 people were injured. This is NPR News. A top Russian official has come out against NATO membership for former Soviet states. In a report, Russian Foreign Intelligence Chief Yevgeny Primakov says that would increase political tensions and force Moscow to change its defense policy. Primakov says Russia would not be able to ignore the fact that the world's largest military bloc was at its door. NATO plans to allow some East European countries to join the alliance. British novelist, critic, and composer Anthony Burgess has died after a long bout with cancer. He was one of Britain's most prolific contemporary writers, producing some 50 novels and at least 15 nonfiction works. Burgess's most famous book was the early 1960s novel A Clockwork Orange, which Stanley Kubrick made into a movie about 10 years later. In an interview with the BBC, Burgess complained the film misrepresented his book.
In the British edition, the story of a young thug who commits all possible crimes ends up by this young thug seeing the futility of violence, wanting to grow up and become the father of a child and a faithful husband and a decent working man, was regarded in England as reasonable enough, because people do change, even young thugs change. But in America, they wanted to end on a kind of unregenerate note, the young thug deciding to be a young thug forever. And of course, it was out of this version that the film was made.
Anthony Burgess was 76 years old. The Belgian relief group Médecins Sans Frontières, or Doctors Without Borders, hopes to return to the Angolan city of Quito soon, perhaps by tomorrow. The group was evacuated from Quito this week because of renewed fighting there. Médecins president Reginald Morils says he was deeply distressed by what he'd seen in Quito. Morils calls it a forgotten enclave of the Angolan civil war, without medical care, hospitals, and food. The battle for Quito has been one of the most brutal in the war. This is NPR News from Washington.
This is Fresh Air. It's sometimes hard for young actors to hold their own when playing opposite big stars. John Leguizamo has no trouble holding his own with Al Pacino in the current film Carlito's Way. Leguizamo plays Benny Blanco, a drug dealer on his way up in the criminal underworld. He's challenging Pacino's turf, and in this scene, he comes to Pacino's nightclub and sends over a bottle of champagne.
Carlito, this is from Benny Blanco.
Send it back.
Vete. Charlie, please, you can't do this. Benny Blanco spends a lot of money here.
He's a nickel bagger. Come on.
What happened to you? What are you acting like this for? It doesn't make sense you should hate this guy, because this guy is you 20 years ago.
Never me. Never me.
Hey, Mr. Brigante, it's the second time you turned me down for a drink, man. What, you don't like my champagne?
Hey, could be.
I don't know, maybe it's a misunderstanding here. I don't know, man. Maybe you don't remember me. My name is
Benny.
Maybe
I don't give a... Maybe I don't remember the last time I blew my nose either. What, you think you like me? You a punk. Why don't you get lost? Go ahead, snatch your purse. Come on, take up a walk.
Over the summer, John Leguizamo starred in Super Mario Brothers. When Leguizamo was starting out, some people told him to try and pass for white, not to limit himself to being Hispanic. He says he had to prove to everyone that being Hispanic wasn't limiting. So Leguizamo created Mambo Mouth, a one-man show featuring a gallery of Latino characters. It was an off-Broadway hit, and then an HBO special. Recently, it was released in book form. His second one-man show, Spikorama, was also shown on HBO. When I spoke with Leguizamo in 1991, we started with a clip from Mambo Mouth. Here he is as Agamemnon, the macho host of the public access talk show Naked Personalities.
Let's start the show, as we always do, by reading letters from women that want to be loved by me around the world. And this first letter is from a woman that wants to be loved by me in El Salvador. Nice little underdeveloped country. And it says, "Dear Mr. Agamemnon," she repeats me, "I am a Republican single Hispanic woman. Please come to my rescue, invade me, blockade me, dictate me." I didn't see that it continued. "Spill your oils on my virginal beaches. Deplete me of my natural resources. Be mine forever, yours in Christ Mimosa."
I think it's great the way you could do characters who are so physically different. You know, you do this real macho Agamemnon talk show host, and then you do Manny the Fanny, who's a transvestite.
That's right, Cindy Crawford's better-looking sister. That's right. You better talk to me, girl. What you got to problem? Tell me, go ahead, talk to me.
Where did you get the clothes, the speech, and the body language from? Or was this based on somebody in particular?
Well, the emotional life. See, all my characters are like a collage effect, you know. It's like they come from all kinds of inspirations. I mean, I felt that the soulful part of it was my mom, and then she spoke like my cousin, Mirtha. And then I modeled the physicality on this transvestite called Sassy that I went downtown and researched. Downtown New York is 14th Street and the meat market, if anybody wants to go do some more research. And this transvestite named Sassy, that was her nickname. And she just talked to me, and she was dancing on the street and telling me about how she wears flat shoes so nobody comes and beats up so she could run away, because if she wore high heels, they would kill her.
Another character you do is Loco Louie, and in this sketch he loses his virginity. Well, he's telling a friend about losing his virginity with a fat prostitute, right. And he's bragging about how he's become a man, but the experience was actually very confusing and disappointing.
Mm-hmm.
Who is this based on?
Well, I'm not going to tell you exactly who it's based on, but you can probably guess. I mean, the reason I created that character was, I mean, I was like that crazed little kid, you know, and I know a lot of Latin people have these wild personalities. They're really funny, and I love so much. And so I give that as a tribute to that. But the whole story that he tells of losing his sexuality was because when I was 13 and 12, as a matter of fact, sex was already so important, and I noticed that in white culture it wasn't so important. I mean, 13-year-old white kids aren't so obsessed with having sex. I mean, talking about it and sneaking maybe Playboys, but I mean, because I guess you grew up in the inner city. I'm talking about inner city life. And you don't have that much toys. You don't travel to Europe on weekends. You know what I'm saying? You don't have all these distractions. The only few things you have are sports and sex. You know what I'm saying? So it's like sex became such an important issue in my life. You know, because all my friends had it, or they were telling me they had it. And I'm sure some of them did have it. So that it became really important. And people were dating, and we were having spin the bottle, playing dentist, and turn off the lights and fill up the girl parties, you know? And we were only 13. So, I mean, that's what it was. It was so important to us to have it, and that's why this kid brags about it, makes such a big deal about it. And to have sex, regardless of how much he was in love or not in love, was not the issue. It was just to have sex and be able to say that I had it. I'm a man. I belong. I'm coming of age.
So should I ask you if you lost it with a prostitute?
Well, I lost it before that. No, I lost it when I was 13, if you could call it losing it. I wasn't sure. I didn't finish the whole act, so I don't know if you... I was pushed off. So I don't know if I finished it. But I guess that's losing it. And then I almost lost it again. And then I finally did lose it with a prostitute when I was a little older.
Well, this character, this Loco Louie character that you do, he feels like, well, now he's really got it. Now he's really a man. So he's hanging on the corner, you know, making...
screaming it out at all his friends or anybody who cares to listen.
Yeah, and making kissing noises at the women who go by and saying, like, hey, baby, how about a little tongue drill? did you do that kind of stuff on the corner?
I did that kind of stuff. And kids still do it. And I'm amazed when I see a 10-year-old doing that because, you know, especially... inner-city street kids. I mean, there's Latin people come in so many different factions, and I'm not talking about all Latin people. I'm talking about certain types of people and types that I related to. And yeah, you know, it was, my ex-girlfriend was walking down the street, and all these little 10-year-old kids were making all these comments at her, and she was just cracking up, you know? I mean, some women are offended by those kind of comments, but I just find that, I don't know. I guess it depends, you know? I think guys are showing their appreciation of a woman, but nowadays it would be sexual harassment, right?
Well, it doesn't always feel like an appreciation when you're the woman walking by and someone's making those kissing noises at you.
Yeah, I guess it's tough.
So
I won't be doing it anytime soon.
Yeah, no,
right?
No, I want you to stop doing that, John.
All right, it's just me in every corner. If you hear, "Ay, mommy, mira," it's me, all right? And I'm just joking.
Now, you tried acting before doing Mambo Mouth. I mean, you did act before.
I tried
acting.
What are you getting at, Terry?
It didn't come out right.
You think I failed or something? Should I try again? Yeah, no.
Do it until you get it right, John.
All right, I will. I promise. I will be trying. Seriously.
What kind of roles were you getting before Mambo Mouth? I know you did Casualties of War.
Right, which was a pretty interesting role, especially for a Latin person, because I wasn't a drug dealer. I wasn't... a scam artist. I wasn't a junkie or cleaning somebody's house or an illegal alien. So that was unique in that sense. The only problem I had with the role was that it was so underwritten, I felt, you know. It was a very pivotal role in the movie, and not just because I'm an actor that I wanted a bigger part, but I just felt it was unwritten because being Latin, you become too representative for all of Latin people. You know, when I write my pieces... all of a sudden, it's like if Eugene O'Neill, to pick anybody at the top of my head, wrote Long Day's Journey into Night, and that was representative of all white people, there would be so many people being on his case going, well, my mother wasn't a junkie. My father's not an alcoholic. How dare you? But that's what happens with Latin work, is that it becomes overly symbolic and representative of all Latin people, and it can't possibly be. It can only be my Latin experience. And so when I act sometimes, I take that burden on myself, I guess voluntarily, being the masochist that I am, that when I did Casualties, I just felt, God, it was so underwritten, and he was the one that was two-faced and wasn't strong enough, couldn't talk up for himself. So that kind of bothered me.
John Leguizamo is my guest. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. We're featuring a 1991 interview with John Leguizamo, who's now co-starring with Al Pacino in Carlito's Way. Now, I'm interested in finding out more about you. You were born in Colombia?
Well, I'm not going to tell you. Go ahead. I dare you. Yeah, I was born in Colombia. So what? Yeah, I'm defensive. What's up, woman? No, yeah, I was born in Colombia, and I came here when I was 4 years old, and then my parents followed. See, I was very innovative.
Well, what made your family decide to move to the States?
I guess lack of opportunities and problems. My dad has Puerto Rican ascendancy, so I'm half Puerto Rican, half Colombian. But they came here because it was just difficult. My dad had a whole bunch of jobs in South America, and it just like he was a very ambitious man, and he wanted to be a film director when he was 19 years old and studied for it. But you know, there was just no opportunities in Latin America. I mean, that's one great thing about America, and even if I put it down sometimes or have a lot of problems, only to make it better, because this is truly the greatest country in the world. I mean, I feel that America is really a land of opportunity, and my parents came here with nothing and worked their culos off. That means their buns in Spanish, just to make something, and they were able to make something of themselves, even though it was a big struggle. And there was a lot of racism and stuff involved. You can still work through it.
What did your parents end up doing professionally?
My father owns some real estate, and my mom, she was a business manager at a German bank.
Mm-hmm.
She handled Latin affairs stuff. But my father, I mean, when they first came here, my father had two jobs in restaurants, and he tried to pass himself off as Italian so that he wouldn't have to be washing dishes in the kitchen, because he was light-skinned enough and his features were passing enough so that he could pass for Italian. And so he'd tell him that he was Italian and fake an Italian accent. I guess that's where I got my acting skill from surviving. And then he'd get waitering jobs so he could make more money. And then he'd have two of those jobs or three of them sometimes. I hardly saw my father that much when I was growing up. And then my mom worked at a doll factory for a while, and then she became a receptionist and then a secretary. And she moved away, worked really hard. I've come from very workaholic type family.
When your father was passing for Italian, did that used to eat away at him when he came home?
I don't think so. Not my father. I don't want to talk about him anymore, because it's hard. No, it didn't eat away at him. I mean, I think my father had a lot of shame with him. He's always had a lot of shame, I mean, about his accent, and he'd assume. And I assume sometimes that when you go to restaurants and you're given, even my aunts, my family, you just can't help it. You go to restaurants and you're given like this weird, funky table all the way in the back. You think it's because of who you are, because of your ethnicity, because you're Latin, and they dislike you. But sometimes I don't think it's that, you know?
Sometimes it's just the only table left.
Yeah, sometimes it is only table, and sometimes it is racism. It's just, and it's so hard to be able to sometimes put away and just be objective and take each moment as it is. But sometimes you just carry on that burden with you. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, yeah. No, I read about you that you, when you decided you wanted to act, you tried to find an acting school from the phone book.
I did. My fingers did the walking, and I went to the Yellow Pages, and I found this place called Sylvia Lee Showcase Theater. And I said, "Showcase, that sounds good." And I went there, and I studied with this lady who thought she was Vivian Lee, doing Streetcar Named Desire. Sweetest little lady, and she took me and took my money, and actually, the first scene I did, I was amazingly incredible. I mean, I said, "Damn, boy, I'm seriously talented." And I did it, and I got a lot of some people from NYU. I was 17, and some NYU people wanted to do films with me and whatnot. But then every scene I did after that was so bad, I didn't understand what happened. And that's when I continued acting for the rest of my life and pursuing it.
So was the school helpful at all?
It was, totally was. I mean, to have studied, and she tried to work real hard on my diction and my speech because she said, you know, don't limit yourself. You can be so many other things. Don't limit yourself with your accent and things like that, which happened to me a lot in my career. I auditioned for Juilliard, and I guess I wasn't Elizabethan enough. It was kind of hard in Jackson Heights when everybody talks, hey, yo, what's up, man, what's up? But I took out records from Sir John Gielgud and tried, is this a dagger which I see before me? The handle taught, and I did it just like the record did at the audition. And this lady said, excuse me, but you have a too thick a New York City minority accent. I said, and what do you have, lady? A Long Islandese accent, perhaps? And she said, you're very talented, but you just have an accent, and we can't put you in Juilliard. But I still struggled. I never gave up.
Well, John, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Always a pleasure, Terry. Next time, I'll do the same thing.
Okay.
Goodbye, mommy. Meet up.
John Leguizamo, recorded in 1991. He co-stars in Carlito's Way and is currently performing a work in progress called House of Buggin at the Downtown Art Company in New York. This is Fresh Air.
Hello, this is Noah Adams in Washington with a word about what's coming up on All Things Considered. Ed Lifson reports on Thanksgiving travel troubles, lots of bad weather, and a work slowdown at United Airlines. Sylvia Pajoli reports from Croatia on the troubles faced by aid convoys trying to get food into Bosnia. Some progress, some delays there. We'll have letters from listeners about transracial adoption and Bailey White, plus a Bailey White story that goes 20 years back into her history. And some music for Thanksgiving, some of the old Shaker hymns done instrumentally. Also, a salute from London to novelist Anthony Burgess, the author of Clockwork Orange and scores of other books. Mr. Burgess died at 76. That's coming up later on All Things Considered from National Public Radio.
This Sunday, NBC is bringing back Bonanza, its most popular series of the 1960s. It's coming back as a telemovie, but if it does well, NBC is likely to bring it back as a series. TV critic David Bianculli has a review.
The new Bonanza opens with that old music and with similar opening credits. There's a map of the Ponderosa still going up in flames, and the cast still rides in on horseback, with that tough old coot riding herd over a good-looking younger generation. Except that Lauren Green isn't the patriarch this time, and the other saddles aren't filled by Dan Blocker, Michael Landon, and Pernell Roberts. After all, except for Roberts, all those actors are dead. And Roberts, who played Adam Cartwright, left the original Bonanza after 5 years. There was no way he was going to come back for a remake. And actually, Bonanza has been remade before, twice, each time as a telemovie. But the reason NBC is getting behind this one so heavily is because of the recent flap over TV violence. Bonanza the Return was pitched and sold by stressing the same ingredients that made it such a hit in the first place. It was a relatively nonviolent Western, full of moral issues and family values. The Cartwrights displayed a love of the land and respect for their elders, and were fierce and brave and loyal when it came to protecting their property and each other. Come to think of it, the sensibility of Bonanza was a lot more Indian than cowboy. In this new Bonanza, like in James Michener's Centennial, the land is the only continuing character who's still around. Veteran character actor Ben Johnson plays Bronk, Ben Cartwright's best friend. When Ben died, he left a will that charged Bronk with calling all the far-flung relatives back to the Ponderosa. At the same time, Bronk has to head off an evil land baron, like there's any other kind, who wants to buy the Ponderosa. Dean Stockwell plays the bad guy, Augustus Brandenburg.
I'll give you $3 million.
The Ponderosa isn't for sale at any price.
$5 million.
You can't fool me, Brandenburg. I've done a little investigating on my own. It seems you have a bad habit of buying up land just to clear cut the forest and strip mine the soil till there's nothing left.
I don't know where you got that information, but I'm against clear cutting, and all my mining operations are clean.
That sort of environmental awareness is really out of place in a Western set in 1905. But then there's a lot about this new Bonanza that doesn't feel quite right. Even though the real Michael Landon Jr. plays the son of Little Joe, his actions and his acting don't fit the part. And the same, more or less, goes for Emily Warfield as Little Joe's daughter, Brian Lechner as the son of Hoss, and Alastair MacDougall as the son of Adam. The only workable cast changes, in fact, are in the older generation. Johnson is just right, and Jack Elam as the new cook is the most fun of all. But even though it's updated, this new Bonanza feels dated, period. The music and direction are old-fashioned, the plot is standard, and the new footage doesn't have any of the fun or flavor of the old Bonanza flashbacks. NBC is gambling that Sunday's telemovie will be popular enough to justify a weekly return to the Ponderosa, but I wouldn't bet the ranch.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Joan Tui, with Nancy Greenlease and Peter Clowney. Research assistance from Louisa Shafia. Abby Fanta and Devin Reif are our interns. All of us at Fresh Air wish you a happy Thanksgiving. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the Vanguard Group of Investment Companies, with 74 mutual fund portfolios offering comprehensive investment and retirement services. 1-800-643-3393. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Maurice Sendak. We talk with the author of such classic children's books as Where the Wild Things Are and The Night Kitchen about his own childhood. And Michael Caine gives us some tips on acting. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next archive edition of Fresh Air.